Sergeant Bushers on 15 Lectures Ago, I preface my remarks, my talks, by saying that in the Gems it was history in reverse, from being a nearly a great natural beauty in other instances. You find places becoming commercialized, industrialized, slag heaps, all the paraphernalia of progress. And in these conservation days and days of pollution, people are now beginning to see just what damage has been done by the march of time. And places, very beautiful places, especially in England, some in the north of Scotland, and indeed at the present time around the Scottish coast, look like being destroyed forever by industrialist men seeking oil. In the Dunes, if you remember, I said that before most of these places were ever heard of, and the Esso Oil Company was far in the future. There was a great exporting market from the Dunes of flints and things like this to many parts of the British Isles. So that what once was a factory centre and a place of industry with exports going out to people engaged in husbandry, now you have an idyllic holiday area. It's unbelievable. But what we're going to discuss tonight is a period when industry seemed just to be attracted towards the good, and it looked for a moment as if all the tranquility was to disappear forever. If I were thinking of the Glens as I like them, I'm not saying, of course, that if industry came along or if the oil merchants suddenly hit the shore, that they should be turned away. But in 1811, Duverdieu was doing a survey. The book, incidentally, is now valued at £25, and it just gives you some idea of the Duverdieu's contribution to the social history of the county. Christian Dahl, in the barn at Glenarm, which has been lately renamed Newton Glens, that was because the then proprietor, a surgeon Richardson, decided to drop the old name and call it Newton Glens. Turnley was to restore. It's beautifully situated on the stream of Glenagh, which falls into the bay of Christian Dahl. This place is well adapted to please those who wish to make excursions to the romantic country which lies about it. A most comfortable, though small, house of entertainment to retire to contributes to render some days' residence there the more agreeable. The arrangements of the coast thereabouts and a considerable portion of the materials of which the mountains and valleys are formed is totally different from the rest of the country. It's well worth the attention of the mineralogist. Now, there he's talking about the Glens, a romantic country, a place to retire to spend a few days. Incidentally, the house of entertainment was the Glens of Antrim Hotel. It was built as an inn, Bannister Turnley, some 160-170 years ago. Unfortunately, it has now disappeared. I only hope that what replaces it will be just as pleasing. Now, let's just at the start of the Industrial Revolution, remembering what I told you, I'm terrified of that blue chuck, remembering what I told you about the Glens, the Glen Sheskin, Glen Tatey, and then you had Glen Dunn, and
of this Lakota.
Now, this central area here, the five middle towns, were an enclave greatly cut off, this to the sea, back to the hill. Here, up at the Benicasquez, the man who made more changes than any industrialist on the coast before or since was a man called Hugh Boyd. And in the last issue of the Glens, the third one, incidentally, is due shortly, Cahill Gallup talked of Barry Caspel's glass industry. Doherty, referring to it, said that, I just get you the actual quote, he'd been talking about the influence of oil, and he said that a glass house, a glass house had been built many years ago, but the business has now given up. Manganese has been discovered, but the quality of it is inferior to that imported from England. Now, it was possible, you see, that was a survey which Doherty did in 1811. Remember, Doherty, Huguenot, that type of man, when we were talking about the Crumlin influence, you could still come in from Coleraine on the route into this part of the Glens. And coal had been discovered and was being, at that time, it was being exported, shall we say. Most of it going to Coleraine, some of it going to Barramina, and as Doherty says, as far away as Antrim. The statistics that I took of that at the time were that blazing coal cost 10 shillings a ton, blind coal 13 shillings a ton, and slack 5 shillings a ton. That when he was there, there was about 100 men employed, and that they were turning out 60 to 120 tons of coal in a fortnight, and 10 to 30 trams of slack. The proprietor, as I said, was Mr. Boyd. It says here, as Jupiter says, that previous to the year 1736, the mines were occupied by a company mostly composed of Englishmen. In that year, Alexander, Earl of Antrim, Grantham, and perpetuity to Hugh Boyd, Esquire, of Ballycastle, great-grandfather of the present Mr. Boyd. The grant conveys all coals, pits, etc. And you know that the mines were in operation until very recently. And when the Ballycastle narrow gauge was opened, one of the commentators at the time, I think, in the directory for Antrim of the year 1880 or thereabouts, talked about the great future with the railway arriving, with the coal mines, and with the industry of the people that Mr. Boyd and those who followed him had brought and encouraged. Now, at that time also, there was potteries in Ballycastle. It's fashionable now, no matter where you go, to find that somebody's making pottery from, say, Ballyagan or Ballymuir or Ballyclare. I find myself going down the west of Ireland, there seems to be different pottery for every town land. I suspect it was probably all the same, like Hong Kong pottery. But in Ballycastle in those days, although Doherty said that the manufacture of pottery was just in its infancy, it promises to do very well, and that all kinds of crockery ware at Liverpool prices, I don't know why Liverpool possibly was the centre of the crockery trade, were on sale. He said that the clay for pottery making was equal to any in England. Incidentally, kelp, and I mentioned kelp for the manufacture of iodine, was at that time selling at 6 to 15 shillings a hundredweight. And some of the best kelp was coming from Rattray. That was an age in which, in Ballycastle, every shop sold side stores. And I noticed that they were selling the fourpence a piece that were sold or made by the dozen, and they were exported to all the surrounding areas. It was because of the availability of a very good sandstone for making side stone. And Bancastle was the centre of that trade. To show you how times have changed and how to many of us the size man on the corn with the stone going, it's unbelievable that he's now only recalled on canvas, and he was very much a part of our upbringing. But that was the great centre for side stones in those days. Ballycastle was undoubtedly the place, the metropolis, and although Turnley and later Crumlin were to try and bring industry, as I would describe, to the middle grounds, Ballycastle was the forerunner, and I suppose to this day remains the capital, though don't tell the Cushion Dog people I said that. Candor, writing of the glass industry, said, in 1754 the Ballycastle Glass House Company was formed, and in a Dublin newspaper, Hughes Occurrences, June 8, 1754, it stated, there is a glass house erecting in Ballycastle by a company for the making of bottles, window glass, plate glass, which when finished will be as a complete a building of the kind as any in Europe. The glassworks were erected on a site close to the east side of the inner dock of the old harbour. Now, for those of you who know Ballycastle, I'll try and just give you some idea of what Cathal had on this in mind. I hope you that I do justice. This is the inside of the bay, and the Margie River running down here. There was a dock area here running towards a pier, and you had the coal, the railway line coming in along here. Now this was an inner dock where you could lay up ships in safe anchorage, and then the pier out here, Mr. Boyd's Pier as it was called, was for boats hoped to take on heavy cargo. But I suppose a ship traveling light could lie in the inner dock. He says that they were erected on the east side of the inner dock, that would be on this side, and that near the wooden footbridge which crossed the Margie River on a plot of ground on which they stood, known to this day as the Glass Iron. The glass kiln was similar to the English glass house, but the very unglazed, as illustrated in Diderot's encyclopedia. Well, I haven't gone with me. It was cone-shaped, 90 feet high, 60 feet in diameter at the base. It was built of red brick from the clay obtained in Miller's farm at Brackney in Glenchester, now occupied by Mr. A. McCann. The date of erection, 1755, was formed by projecting bricks on the west side of the halfway up. Now, this was the start of a great trade, and Dugard Hughes said, what, 18 and 11, clothes all gone. There are descriptions of people working on it and things such as this. The glass, I noticed in Dugard Hughes, there was a coarse sort of sand which was used for making glass in the time. There were six glass blowers said to be there. One of these, Lockie Black, a native of Rapton, Richard Johnson, James Hill, John McGauley, and there's Richard McGauley's burying places at Drumaholy. To give you some idea of where you might see samples or examples, in a pane of Ballycastle glass, spinning lines can be seen near the bullion. Some panes of Ballycastle glass can be seen in the Holy Trinity Church in the Nine. There are several items of Ballycastle glass in Belfast Museum. A large glass, a wine glass, a large goblet, two cordial glasses. In the National Museum in Dublin, there's a bowl of that incandescent glass about 8 inches in diameter and 4.5 inches. And it was donated to the museum by Mrs. Woods of Dublin. Her maiden name was Gordon, and her people lived in the house near the glass house. Lots of glass can still be found, says Cahill, at Ballycastle Beach. And he says that with all the materials available and with the great work put into it and the great future that was prophesied in the European papers, it was all over in 30 years. He says that one of the causes of its failure was an act of Parliament in 1746 which placed a duty on the materials used in the manufacture of glass and also stated that no glass of any kind was to be exported from Ireland under penalty of 10 shillings for every pound so exported. I think one of the things that emerges from the relationship between Ireland and England, you remember I was talking about William III, Prince of Orange, appreciating the jealousy of the English traders had destroyed the great Holland trade in the wool, and that he personally had decided, in spite of them, that he would bring over the Cromlins and he would set up trade in Ireland. There you find an act of Parliament designed at killing the Irish glass trade, and it effectively killed what maybe today would have been one of the finest trades here on the coast, because glassware, waterford glass, the crystals that we know from the various parts of Ireland at the present time are and compare very favourably with any in England. And it may well be that the English realised that the Irish glassblowers as tradesmen, or craftsmen, shall I say, I shouldn't use that word, craftsmen, could compete with them on equal terms. But there, Cahill puts it forward, the Gandron and Historical Society have a very worthy representative from the Ballycastle area, and he says here that's one of the reasons, and I would think that it probably is the main reason, because it was just impossible to compete with that type of suppression of trade. So Ballycastle in the 18th century, everything going well. Hugh Boyd, a man who had decided to build a harbour and build a pier, unfortunately, as Dubertu said, but while the situation was injudiciously chosen and the work not so skillfully planned and executed as the works of the present time, or that the force of the swell was irresistible, the sea overpowered it, having first filled the little harbour with sand so as to render it nearly useless. To remedy this misfortune, I have heard that the river, which runs into the bay a little to the eastward, was turned in under the idea of clearing away the sand. But this completed its ruin, and that is the state in which it now remains. The dream of a man just silted up, the pier swept away, and the coal mines still struggling, the glass gone, and the pottery industry quite obviously didn't thrive. But if ever a town deserved to remember a man, and someday in Ballycastle some of the young should do a thesis on Boyd and what he tried to do for the area, I think that he's a grand man who deserves to be remembered. Turnley and Cromwell. Well, Turnley had ideas, political ideas. Turnley was sitting philosophizing while Boyd was hard at it. And I suppose the tranquility of the Middle Glens allowed him plenty of time, and the money that had been made out in the Indies allowed him to take his ease. It's not that Boyd didn't get help, because Parliament granted him grants up to 23,000, a lot of money in those days, but they thought it was well spent, and there was nothing harebrained at all about this man's ideas, if he had got the support. He was working with the material close at hand. He wasn't going away up into the mountains to draw it down. The coal was there, the sand was there, the labor was there, the sea was there, everything was going for him. Possibly vocation was the big thing against him, and envy of others. But Turnley, now, Turnley had dreams, political dreams. And it's interesting that when Duverdrew talks of the Glens, he talks about Ballycastle, devotes a lot of time to it and to Mr. Boyd. He talks about the Larne in that area and Carrickfergus. Any reference he makes to the Middle Glens is on the romantic theme and purely as a mineralogist, he calls it. But it's quite clear that there's just no industry, none. And the thing that you notice missing, there's no reference whatever to iron ore. There's iron turning trades and things like this in Belfast and some other centres. Incidentally, he says that you find traces of it even to this day. The late, I can always remember, the late Sir Nixon used to live at Newport Lane. And this was because of where the forge used to be out at that side of the city. There's old forge lane. Those were instances of where iron turning was taking place. But no mention in 1812 of iron ore. Turnley, down in the Glens, cutting roads through and building his inn. Obviously, still with the idea, this is a place of rest. And this is a place where a man could come to and bestow himself and go away refreshed. Then Cromlin came, as I told you, around about 1824-26, when he had the idea of the village that we talked about the last day. And in and around the Glenapple area, we find that he was nosing about. I want to cut this down to the essentials that I can. From the Journal of the Chemical Agricultural Society in June 1882, we find an article by Frederick Hodges. Those of you who know Glenapple, coming through the village of Carr and going towards Ballymena, you pass through what used to be Hodges Plant. I remember it was a boy because he was supposed to occasionally, long after his death, make appearances there. And I used to pursue it in the car of my father, my eyes tight shut in case he would appear in the headlights of the old Forest Cowley in those days. Anything could appear in the headlights of the old Morrises in those days. He, in this article, and I'm greatly indebted to Malachy McSpire of Cushion's Law for helping me in this. He said that from the absence of iron furnaces at the present day in Ireland, from some of the foregoing statements, it might be thought that when the forests were destroyed and no charcoal could be obtained, the inhabitants of Ireland had made no attempt to smelt iron by the employment of fuel other than charcoal. But such is not the case. In or about the year 1843, a Mr. Cromlin, a descendant of the well-known Louis Cromlin, the Huguenot exile, who did so much for the linen trade, a proprietor of Newton Cromlin, a mountain village in the parish of Donaghy, about 10 miles from Ballymena, requested Professor Hodges of Queen's College, Belfast, to examine a mineral found in the neighbourhood of the village. It was, said Dr. Hodges, a reddish-coloured, somewhat soft rock, breaking with a conchoidal fracture. On analysis, the specimens were found to yield 18-25% of peroxide of iron and 21% of moisture, which could be expelled by calcining the ore. The result of the examination of this ore was, in the eyes of Mr. Cromlin, so satisfactory that he resolved to send some of the ore away for trial as to its smelting qualities, and accordingly He shipped a considerable quantity in vials to the proprietor of a furnace. Now, you find that Barrowman Furnace, Cumberland, these areas are becoming involved with the Glens, and this was the start of it. Whether a favorable or unfavorable report of these samples was obtained is not known, but it is probably either heard or learned something regarding them of a favorable nature, for he immediately commenced to erect a furnace, intending to smelt the ore with coke prepared from the rich carbonaceous turf of the district. The furnace, which was close to the village, was completed after some months and at great expense, and the smelting operations were commenced. Now, here we have Crumlin again. You remember his plea to the linen ore for looms, etc. You remember his countryman scheme for agriculture. And here he is starting to smelt with a furnace outside or very close to the village. The smelting operations were commenced, but though a small quantity of metallic iron was produced, samples of which are still in the possession of Dr. Hodges, that's of course nearly 100 years ago, unfortunately it was found impossible properly to separate the metal from the scoria, and although repeated trials were made, the results were always the same and the works had to be abandoned. The cutting of this furnace sounded to most people like the closing, I beg your pardon, the closing of this furnace sounded to most people like the death knell of a lost trade never to be recovered. But fortunately, the proprietor of the adjoining property, Mr. Ben, was not of this opinion. This is the same Ben of the Ben Hospital and others, and he was the proprietor of an area around Carden and Dungonnell, that's where the new dam now is. He had, even before Crumlin's time, been on the lookout for ore on his estate at Glenravel. He'd given instructions to his tenant to preserve samples of different stones found by them on their mountain farms. And sometime before the year 1843, he had forwarded to Professor Hodges ores for similar examination. To that which was afterwards worked in Newton Crumlin. Even though Crumlin's attempt had failed, Ben decided that he would renew his efforts to discover a better class of ore. Not believing in the proper popular idea that ironstone of a northern mountain was too poor for smelting. After the closing of Crumlin's furnace, two samples of ore were brought to Mr. Ben. One was found on adjoining property on the mountain of Balsala, the other was picked up on his own property on a mountain in the ordnance maps known as Slieve na Nearan. That would be Slieve na Nee. In fact, the Gaelic definition of that would be the mountain of iron, rough definition. So that possibly someone long before his time had something of the same idea. These samples were shown to a Dr. Buchan, a Scotsman interested in the mining operations, and to a Mr. Ryan of Belfast, who was a well-known iron planter. The Scotsman said that the Balsala sample was weak, a luminous ore, and wouldn't pay the carriage to the furnace. But he thought that the other from Slieve na Nearan, had first-class appearances, and then directed a tenant, John McAllister, a blacksmith in Leggy Grant, to smelt or try to smelt the sample. Now, Mr. McAllister was one of these men who had no learning in this type of smelting, but he decided to use the ancient Irish iron workers' idea skilled nail worker who was told nothing of the circumstances. The man brought the iron to Mr. Rowan with the shape of a nail, and at the same time remarked that it was as good a sample of Swedish ore as he had ever worked. Though this incident in the history of County Antrim Iron Trader, which I'm informed that it brought Mr. Ben, took upwards of 28 years ago, I have recently verified by an application to Messrs. Ryan and permitted by them to say that they well remember all the above circumstances. Now there was the first real ore with the blacksmith of Leggy Grand, I'm sure somebody in that area would still show you the forge, who produced the first pig of iron that really passed muster. And when it comes to industry, one of course has to pay tribute to Mr. Ben. But you think of the ingenuity of the smith of Leggy Grand saying, the old man used to smelt ore, and he did it with peat and produced the sample. Although this sample of rich ore must be considered the first of its kind, it's not supposed that this was the first sample ever, but it certainly was the one which caused most interest in the area. And although Mr. Ben did a fair bit of research, it was a man called Pat Dorn, who was one of the best known mineralogists of Great Britain, to point out the exact position of immense beds of rich rock which exist in the Drenabel property. In the Dublin University magazine, it said that Father Macaulay, the PP of Drenabel, was the first to make these discoveries. Father Macaulay was interested also in this idea, and as you'll hear, he had great influence on the future working of the mines. But Mr. Hodge says that the credit should go to Dorn, because Dorn brought to Mr. Ben large samples from beds discovered by him on the same mountain, from which the sample out of which the nail manufactured had been found. And you find that in 1867, they got a very good analysis. These samples are found to contain titanic and vanadium acid. The rare metal vanadium, before the analysis of Antrim rocks by Professor Hodge, had not been known to exist in Ireland except in combination with lead. Now, going on to Father Macaulay. Father Macaulay got in touch with an Englishman, James Fisher of Barrow Furness, who was living at Claggan. Now that's over on the Oliva Estate, you know, over on the Braid, at the head of the Braid Valley, where, what's the man's name, Lord? Oh, I never can remember that name. And Father Macaulay told him of this discovery and showed him samples of the ore. And at the places pointed out where Mr. Ben and Mr. Doran had found it, Fisher was so impressed that he had an interview with Mr. Ben, to whom he was introduced by Father Macaulay, and he obtained leave to visit the mine. Then arrangements were made for mining, and an agreement was drawn up giving James Fisher in 1866 the right to draw out the ore. And I want to just cut this down because it's pretty verbose here and there. The success of Mr. Fisher's undertaking became fully known, and many enterprising individuals hastened to obtain the right of search over the different properties in Glenravel and the adjoining districts. Companies were started to open up and work mines wherever valuable ore was discovered, and in many These are either to buy for a handsome sum from the fortunate individual who had already obtained them from the proprietor, and that perhaps for a mere trifle, the right to own his property or to treat with the proprietor himself. Now, the agricultural population of Granramble and the neighboring lands were for a time seriously affected by the scarcity of laborers, owing to the higher wages to be obtained in the mines, and the farmer complained that even by giving double wages of former years, they were not able to get sufficient men, and they were obliged to do the work themselves, as men could not be obtained at any reasonable price. And in a notice which appeared in a local journal at the time, I found that the wages paid to men working outside, filling carts, trimming ore heaps and the like, were generally 12 shillings weekly for shorter hours than farmers would require for them. Well, the miners, few of whom were skilled but chiefly natives of the country, were able to earn 18 to 25 shillings in the same mine. Now, the things were going very well, and the Glenrattle mine problem was shipment, because it was a good distance inland from the sea. And one of the interesting things was that the English Wire Tramways Company proposed to put up a suspension tramway on the Hodgson system to reach from Glenrattle to Red Bay Pier. It asked to be guaranteed the transport of 70,000 tons of ore a year for a certain period, and they would charge 2 shillings a ton. And they reckoned that if that tonnage could be maintained for a certain time, the whole thing would be quite successful. Now, they got their undertakings, and that suspension railway was constructed. I have tried very hard to find some record of it. I'm sure there is somewhere. But the valuation records, etc., just make no reference to the suspension railway. But I remember talking to an old man in Kushidal, and he said that he had not seen the railway, but they had seen the stumps of the uprights, and farmers had hewn them down and used them for firewood and used them for fencing and this sort of thing. Now, it ran down, it came from Cardiff, and it ran down Ballyyemin, and when it came to Lurie, you all know the way Lurie Mountain is at its foot. You know, it's like Table Mountain in South Africa, and it runs out. Incidentally, some of the Gaelic scholars there tell me that the name Lurie was the shin bone. Well, it ran down there, following much the line, I would think, of the railway that later was to go the length of Retreat Station. And then it went over the toll of Lurie and went down to the pier where the schooners lay in. And the only story that ever I heard about it, I hope the lady from Glenrattle will bear me out on this. I'm not going to mention any names because it's still apparently a painful enough matter in some quarters. But two men fought at a shebeen. Remember I told you about the old man, the herd in the mountain above Cargan, and the church paid to supply drink to travellers and paid them so much a year, because if you made your way out of Ballina Market and there was snow, if you were going to survive at all, and we all know even in these days of hard roads how rough it can be up there, if you were going to survive at all, you needed some place in the mountain. And I think it was outside that man's house the two men fought, but one struck the other with a bullwhip and he was killed. And the assailant is said to have got away in one of the buckets going to the pier. Yes. Is that correct? And there was a schooner and it said that he went off and he was never seen again. He certainly was never brought to justice. Let's say he was never brought to trial. I'm not saying what the outcome would have been. It might have been self-defense. He might have been a perfectly valid trial. But he decided that he would put more faith in the suspension then than he would in the lawyer, and I think he probably was right. But that's story emphasized the fact that there was a suspension railway running down. And
he remembered it.
Yes. Yes. Where did it start from, though?
I just don't know, but I was there to swear from.
Yes, I would assume that for those of you who don't know the area too well, if you took the village of Newton Crumlin, there's a little rough road that runs from Newton Crumlin village. It's actually a very beautiful road if you're on it. And you'll see the old slag heaps on either side of the road. And it runs down and you can come on to the Ballyhaven Road, a bit past where Old Parkmore railway station used to be. And those of you who want to go into a very beautiful part of the country for a picnic someday in peace, when you come through Newton Crumlin at the bottom of the village and you're coming from Ballycastle and you have come over Oran, and when you go up, you come down the upper part and you can come to the bottom. Instead of following the road round down to the Ballymena Road, go straight through and you come on very beautiful country. But you'll see the remains of old diggings there. Now, I was told by the Public Records Office, Mr. McMenemy, that the mine at Carman opened in 1873-74 and that it closed in 1879 or 1880, and that then they transferred to the mine at Dungannel, which operated, I'm told, up till 1893. The manager was a man called Williams, and the proprietor, of course, was Mr. Fisher. At Carman village, of course, was called Fisherstown after Mr. Fisher, and the school was called Fisherstown School, which was built at that time. The houses were built by them for the miners, and the men occupying them at that time with a valuation of £3 of names such as Paul McGarry, John Kushner, Alec O'Raw, John O'Raw, Peter Lally or Rally, Peter McCann, and John Fisher. Well, I would assume that he may have been a relative of the proprietor. And at that time, Fisherstown School, which still stands in the village, was built. Now, the overhead railway that I have talked about, though this proposal was favorably received and the tramway put off, it didn't realize its anticipations, and it had to be abandoned. And the next step made in this direction was one which was considered by many when it was first proposed as rather premature. But by perseverance, the promoters of the first narrow gauge railway in Ireland succeeded in carrying out the project of making a mineral line from Ballymena to the foot of Trosten Mountain, running right through the mining country. Since the construction of this line, other narrow gauge lines which tap the mining districts have been successfully promoted, and the difficulties of transit, so far as carriage by rail is concerned, are now but small. And a great future not only for the mine owners, but for the railway companies is approaching. The country now has been thoroughly well known, and large sums of money being annually expended among the people of the district, we may hope to see in time old associations and ideas broken up and new ones created. Now, that was 1882, and as I've said, the mines eventually closed in 1893. But you there have a company building this great overhead tramway or suspension railway, as it was called, something like the thing that runs outside Drogheda, that style, for the cement factory down there. You have the railway company going, and you have people like this man saying, ah, this is the birth of a new era. Here are the railways running right into the heart of the mining country. Here we have transit to all parts of Ireland. A vast, a wonderful future. Well, many people have put forward proposals as to what went wrong. I don't know. I'm not going to comment upon them, only to say that the great industry which Crumlin saw, which Hodges saw, Bob McCauley, Durham, and the proprietors like Fisher and the English Wire Tramway Company all came to nothing. And you can travel up around that area and see the graveyard of a great industrial revolution. Now, around about the time when the English Tramway Company and others were operating or trying to operate in the Glenrapple area down to the pier, and the narrow gauge railways were coming through, ore was discovered at Clough Corr, and they ran a narrow gauge railway. This is described as the first, in fact, that was not the first narrow gauge railway. The first narrow gauge railway was from Clough Corr down Glenara, that's on the east side of Glenara, and running over the old limestone arch and out to the, well, the old pier. There's a few butts of the old pier still to be seen,
yes,
on the coast between Red Bay and, well, on, in Red Bay as you go towards Carnarvon. And the terrace houses I've told you before, and the parochial hall at Red Bay, were houses of the iron ore company, and the engine shed was where the engines were actually put together, and where they were kept and repaired, etc. Now, this describes mining that had been in progress in Newton, Crumlin and Parkmore when speculators looked at the possibility of extracting ore in Glenara. The spot was in the townland of Clough Corr, which was on the Dods estate and the site, incidentally, of the first fish in the Glens in 1904. On December the 27th, 1872, an agreement was made between Lord Antrim and a number of gentlemen who were to become the Glenara Iron Ore and Harbour Company. Incidentally, you'll remember the last night I was telling you of the Crumlin Mining Company Limited of 46 Laura Street, Whitehaven in Cumberland, and that was in 1888. Here's a mining company, the Glenara Iron Ore and Harbour Company. And incidentally, the proprietors of that one that I was talking about, where Mr. Fisher was involved, was the Antrim Iron Ore Company. And you also will remember where I said that various people came along, little companies were started to try and get ore, some of them disappeared, but these were the main ones. The company was formally incorporated with a capital of 130,000. In March 1975, the directors were George Batters, O.B. Shore, J. Begley, and the chairman was Mr. W. McCandlish. They had a lease to work iron ore and iron stone for a period of 29 and a half years from Lord Antrim on the payment of a shilling per ton of ore as rent. And the company also agreed to pay surface damage. In the same year, they also made an agreement with Conway Dobbs for Old Lands and Clough Corr, giving the company certain rights and liberties over Dobbs's land in the payment of an annual rent. One is only, I beg your pardon, now. The ore had to be transported to the furnaces of Cumberland or Scotland, and the company decided to build a railway to carry it to the shore at Carrickmurphy, that's where the old pier, where they intended to build a harbour. The site there was chosen because the water was particularly deep at that point. The writer of this article says you can walk the railway. Well, you can actually see it. If you're driving up the Ballymena Road out of Glenara, you can see the old line and the railway embankment and that marvellous Grinnerton railway duct, I suppose it's called, which still stands to this day. And he goes on to say that the engine shed and the terrace houses, etc., are part of it. He talks about about the viaduct at Greenock. Undoubtedly the finest engineering part of the project, 70 feet high out of Upmore Burn, and still standing without a chip out of it to this day. You remember I told you when they first assembled an engine down at the engine shed and drove up on the opening day, and one can see all the people in the grounds and the man from the iron company there, like one of those western films in which Warren Bond or something used to appear. When the engine driver reached the Greenock Viaduct, he lost his nerve, and the engineer, finding out that he thought the bridge wouldn't carry the engine, shunted it back and forward across and left it slap in the middle of the bridge. And I think time has proven that the engineer was right and the engine driver wrong. But that must have been a great day in the ground. The railway engine chugging our way up there to Clough Corr, and all the top. Now, consider, if you will, for just a moment, when they found gold in California, and men went from all parts of the world battling out, just think of what ore was like in an area where a few years before it, Dubertieu had found nothing. Lovely country, scenic beauty, romantic, lovely inn, you could go and stay there. And suddenly, there was an iron ore rush. The farmers just found that the fellow who was working to them for nothing was away over the mountain to work for the ore. And it must have seemed like El Dorado at that time. A railway coming through from Ballymena, a suspension railway coming down to them. And well, I think that in the, if you ever thought of industrial revolution, there it was, in a very, very, very short period of maybe 20 years or less, suddenly everything had changed. Money from America, men were working, everybody was going. And this company, my father used to tell me, just went away. He said that he just left bars with shovels sitting in them the way a man might have been weeding in the garden and come out to finish it after tea. They just never came back. Although someone today said that he understood that the Atom Iron Ore Company had still an address in Bangor, but I believe that they have still a registered office in London. Now, despite the amount of money which had been invested, mining in Glenara lasted 3 years. The engine shed, the pier, the white arch down there, that marvelous opening day, 3 years. Oh, the locals say that the man, the engineer, didn't know the ground well enough, and that they dug in the wrong way, and that the mine spluttered, and that the whole thing was disastrously planned. But nobody apparently told them. Maybe the glass people thought that that would wheel it out of it. It's like the man who went to Ballymena when they opened the Peru first, and he was the only man there the first day, and when he went back the next week, there was a queue. And he said it's like everything else to start in this town, a crowd will destroy it. Well, I think a whole lot of people in the towns thought that they strung out the system, you see, and you didn't get the stuff out quick enough, that it would last the longer. I think that the history of the unraveling the glands showed that, in fact, they cut their throats in many ways. The company decided, taking into consideration the remoteness of the mines from the furnaces and the fact that Spanish ore could be more cheaply imported, that the Glenara period was not worth of investment. And then the writer of this article says, a masterpiece of interest in any case, they were probably broke. He said that the last time the train ran was in October 1880, and that was from William Trail, a civil engineer from Bush Mills, took a group of businessmen in an attempt to get them to join with him in a scheme to open up the line from Glenara through Parkmore to Ballymena. He saw what a whole lot of people today say, tragically, is not there. That you could get on to a little narrow gauge scenic train of Ballymena and tootle out right down to the sea. Isle of Man, all these places, they held on to it, but nobody listened to Mr. Trail. And they thing was abandoned, and it was officially abandoned by an Act of Parliament, Westminster, in 1885. There was a great lawsuit over it between the Antrims and the Delvises. I won't go into that. But the rails were lifted. They were valued at £869. And the whole thing came to an end. Incidentally, the engines, which were known as the Cushion Dolls, were bought by the Londonderry and Locksley Railway Company. And they had to get them from the engine shed over to Red Bay Pier. There was no railway line, so they took them along the road. And they were pushed along the road. And the journey, as the railway said, took longer than any other journey that they had ever undertaken. But they did run on the Locksley line for many years. And whether, in fact, any of them are extant, well, one would have to ask some of those enthusiasts who have succeeded in opening a stretch of the line from the station down at Derry, running out towards, or running out along the Swilly. But there, again, was a three-year history of a company into which a fortune had been poured. There was the Ballycastle Glassworks, the coal mines. There was the Overhead Railway, the Narrow Gauge Railway, all gone. And today, as I said, if you were up around that area, you can see around Newton Cumberland, Glenrabble, and into Glenara, the history on the very ground of a period of astonishing industry. Furnaces, lime kilns, old railway lines, everything, the old pier, the arch, the whole history is there for any person who wants to see what happened when people sank a fortune in industry in an area which was totally unsuited to it. Now, at the other end of the Glens, up in Glenfloy, that was the Churchill country, they had limestone. And also between that old pier that I'm talking about and Garnon Point, they had limestone. Those of you who use the coast will see where the Antrim County Council have cut vast slices of limestone out and used it to run to make a wall along the coast, and used it to fill in the breakwater. That was a very well-known mining area back about just about the same time as the iron ore was being transported. And if you're going from Waterfoot and travelling towards Carnarvon, when you come into Arclinus Turn, that's where Red Bay swings left to go out towards Carnarvon. When I talk about Red Bay, I mean where you come across the Bobbitshire from Waterfoot along by the Strand, bear around through the White Arch and the old pier out here, and we're out here, then your bay runs like that. Now up here, you'll see coming down the face of the mountain the mark of the old track where they had a railway for hauling stone. And if you are going towards Carnarvon, the only habitations on the seaside of the road once you pass Red Bay until you reach Garn Point are two white houses sitting on the left of the road. You'll see them sometimes in photographs for American tourism. You see these two white cottages on your left going towards Carnarvon. If you stop there and go down, you'll find the remains of a beautiful limestone quay at Fallamee. It's unfortunately split up the middle, but you see the bombers there. And there used to be a great lime exporting industry there. Fallamee Quay, I think you would probably see you see it on the ordnance sheet. And I remember, I think I'm telling you about a man called Orr, ancestry back to the famous William Orr, who was executed in Carrick in 1797. And the last Orr was the postmaster at Waterford and the harbour master. It was his father or grandfather. I think I told you the old man said he was the strongest man he'd ever seen, how he used to get into the shafts of the schooner and tip the oar over his head into the hold of the boat, and how when the oar ran out he went to Fallabee to work at the limestone with his horse and cart, and when that went out, how he went to Carnlough, and how he would come home in the evening and work a rig or two of whatever he had on the wee farm, and how on a Saturday evening he washed out the cart, put the youngsters in it on the Sunday, and trotted it round to the Reverend the clergyman around at Muller's. I remember his name in a moment or two. But that was the industry dying out, a man following it with his horse and cart, because you got so much, I think a shilling a ton for bringing it down from Glenravel on horse and cart. Then along came the steam engines with wagons behind them. I remember them drawing into Ballymena when I was a boy from up that valley. That valley outside Ballymena, between Ballymena and Glenravel, they had ore. An outcrop of ore there, and it ran for... It ran for many years, and I remember the old engine hopping in the Brochet Road with two great big wagons loaded with the ore. But in the Glens, it faded out. But you find that limestone, if you look at your Architectural Society's book, you find that in Carnlough at that time, the bridge runs over the middle of the town and carried the limestone railway, which brought stone from the great quarries on the hillside behind the town to the harbour, built by Lord and Lady Londonderry. It was completed in 1854. Characteristically, Francis Anne had engraved a stone set up to commemorate the landing of Francis Anne, then Marchioness of Londonderry, on her own pier at Carnlough Harbour on the 20th of August, 1855. She came up by steamer, I think it was, and there was a great day at the pier, and this was the commemoration day. Well, all of you who know Carnlough know the that is the arch there in your magazine, in the centre of the town. The railway ran over the top of it and ran out into the harbour. Unfortunately, that trade too has gone. And a decade, maybe 15 years ago, there were two little Dutch boats ran in and out there for maybe a year, maybe 2 years, carrying limestone to the continent, and doing very well. But that trip has gone, and Carnlough Harbour is now a pleasure resort for people who like to come down along the coast and fish and sail and do all sorts of things. The little harbour is jammed with those, and some commercial fishermen who put up their trawlers in there. Glenarm, well, the limestone still is quarried there. The Eglinton Limestone Company still work to this day, and you've only to go through the village on a blowy day with your good suit on to know that it's still operating. But there was industry in the Glens, and there, at various parts of it, you had the proprietors. The inns that Dubertu saw were the ones that one would want to survive. But someone told me recently that we may well see the oil rigs off the coast. I saw one going up one evening there on tow in the summertime with a tug taking her up past the Mullet and Tyre. And it looked a vastly even far out at sea. And I wonder what it would be like if they were close inshore. I went to the Abbey Theatre in Dublin last year to see The Chivvy of the Stag and the Black Black Oil, done by the 784 Theatre Club from Scotland. It was written by, well, not a play, though it's hard to know what a play is these days, but written by John McGrath of Liverpool. And they did it up round all the little halls through the island. And it described the changes, the chiviot, that was the sheep. The people were moved away, the highland clearances, to make way for the sheep. And the stag, and there was the preserves of the red deer for the Germans who wanted to come over and have a shot at them and pay fast sums, etc. And then the black, black oil, the Americans coming in to spoil the coast. I don't know what turn one would get out of it, but I would hate to think that there could be a repetition of what happened up at the back of the Glens, in Clochcore and over into Glenravel, where some beautiful country was despoiled. Indeed, when you travel that road, you'll see what I mean. And where fortunes were lost, where hopes were built up and faded. And if one wanted to just take the very heart of a country and just tear it in two, take that 20, 30 years in the heart of the 19th century when a peaceful agricultural community became like a gold rush colony, where men turned away from the farms, where everybody thought that the day had arrived when one would no longer have to go out and cut thistles in the field to do that sort of thing. But nothing to show for it other than slag heaps, crumbling furnaces, old lime kilns. Very interesting for the sociologists. It would be a terrible disaster if the same thing happened off the coast and the Americans went away, leaving the skeletal remains of an oil disaster with all the Battery Bay implications. That's my story of the Industrial Revolution. Let me say this about it. It strikes me always when one thinks of the landlord, and Brian Notley hasn't a good name here and there, I think it was Shaw and Back to Methuselah who said, the landlord? No. No, there was a breed existed here about 1,000 years ago, the non-law. Now, as a breed, let's be fair to them. They sent a bloody fortune in the land. And there you have an example of the Cromlins just wiped out by it, of the Turnleys stopped by a jury of assize from doing the same thing. And who knows, the Hodges have gone from Glenravel. Hugh McCann, maybe come back to the manor. Pete McCann, you never know, is now living in the old Hodge home. All those men have gone. And it must have cost them a fortune in the old days to try and mine, and they, I'm sure, were thinking of themselves. But life wasn't terribly easy when you were trying to make a fortune out of long land and the sort of land which came their way. The people who survived were the small farmer who held on to his acreage and sold without any dreams of anything other than getting his wheels to school and living till next Christmas. Thank you very much.
I had a meeting not so long ago, and we were assured of occupation and meeting, and we were assured that there would be no oil of the North Fire, but there might be a serious damage otherwise. Apparently, they are going to build a lot of these oil rigs across around there, near Shakush, and they need a tremendous amount of concrete for them. And the easiest place to get stone is North Antrim, Northeast Antrim.
Yeah.
And it is anticipated that there may be very large quarrying works, millions of tons of stone, we suggest, might happen.
Well, I got a hint of this recently, that certain speculators are very interested in places where stone can be got on our side, where it can be got out. That's very, very interesting. Those of you who are interested in the coast, again, let me tell you that you don't have to have the fellow coming in with the boat to haul out a stone. I still think that the Antrim County Council, I had once asked them to try and be remembered as the county council who had done most for the coast, but one of the last acts that the commissioned was along that stretch of what's called the common land, or the Warren, from Waterford right over to the chapel, where you cattle grazed and hens picked about and you could sit down in the grass. They're going to have camping sites, car parks, all the fun of the fair. And I tried to rally the citizenry to contest, and about a few of them up to County Hall on the day that the vesting order application was heard. Because, as I said, you can't approach the grounds as you do Scarborough or Blackburn. Grounds is a beautiful area to do just as Dubertu's thought, and there's others since. You remember after the gun running, I told you that the lady and gentleman, who the husband who had taken part as the director of the land forces at that time when the guns were being brought into Lorne, went by that little narrow gauge railway and came down to stay the weekend at the feast of the Grounds of Antrim. And this keeps repeating itself. But English people come to find something utterly new, and we seem to be going out of their way to give them what they came from. But they have to say, for God's sake, you're going to destroy the place. I have fought battles on my own to save pieces of it here and there. And I think that those of you who are interested in the Gaelic should look to your challenges, because it may not be the oil companies, it just might be an unheeding commission or council who decides that, I think one way to put it was, but the people want to get to the sea. Yes, and do you mean by that you should provide a large tarmac car park for 1,000 cars? Well, that's the idea. But I said, why must you have those just by the water's edge? Because it's going to reach the stage where they drive into the sea and get out of their cars and some of them drive out again. It's coming close to that. And he said, you can't ask them to walk very far. Well, yes, I said, that's exactly what you must ask them. Because the person who says, I am not going to walk a quarter of a mile from a car park in a secluded area to get to the sea. Over in the Lake District, that's exactly what they ask you to do. And unless people take a stand, you'll be driving along the coast road and you'll be just driving in, getting into your pew, and sitting there staring out. And there's no pleasure in the grounds for anyone if that's going to be the sort of holiday paradise that the planners have envisioned. And I can tell you,
they're mostly backed up by the first floor. Are they not even an enemy in some ways?
Well, you see, tourism, I think the wrong people are promoting tourism. You see, they've all the idea that fancy dress parades and this sort of thing, that's tourism. Those things are done by the English on such a superb scale that we look comical. We're bloody stage Irish when it comes to that. That's the paper route. But
we can offer things that they come to see. I don't know if I told you about a family called McAllister, the school teachers for a father and mother, and they used to go up before the war, relatively up along there in the Western Isles, and then when things were over, back they went again to find that it was all utterly changed, and that Glasgow had swept right up the west side, and the further you went up, the harder it was to get a place where there wasn't abuse, where there wasn't fights outside of it. And one day they said, I wonder if you go over and see what it's like on the other side. And they came to Cushion Dog. And they described how those, the first day they came, it was wet, and they thought, oh my God, this is not much better. However, there seems to be a bit of peace. And they came into the Ganser Mantrum, a little lounge, and ordered a hot whiskey. And how there was a man sitting on the corner, and they got talking. And how the man started to tell them about the Glen, and how they became so fascinated that they came back again. And they were coming for right up until the outbreak of trouble here. And the man we're talking to was myself, thanks to them. They came and they looked at it. And they said that this is what they were seeking. That you would walk into a place and sit down fascinated that they came back again. And they were coming for right up until the outbreak of trouble here. And the man we're talking to was myself, thanks to them. They came. Did you hear what one of the 3:30 or something such as this? That somebody started to ask you where you were from and to tell you what. So I think you maybe find this year in the Grand, if the Historical Society has its way, that sort of atmosphere will certainly be promoted in the middle of that. Yeah.
You know about the Warren, is that Warren
north of Glenara, or is it north of Warren or south? That's Glenara. That's Warren there. That was Lord Antrim's Coningborough, or Coningborough. He used to appear out there for, you know, the furs for the court.
And for repeating too.
That's right. You find in that survey of one of the doctors for Moses Pitt gone about, 1500 and something, that there was a very prolific Coningborough there. Lord Antrim had it in that.
Thank you. I'm so happy to bring this to the most great. Well, I'm glad to finish this.